Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Small Animal Oncology, Irina Graymer. Thank you, Irina. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and welcome everyone to this webinar today, during which we'll discuss different diagnostic approaches to cancer, and especially how you as nurses can get a bit more involved with this topic. So you'll see throughout the presentation there are a variety of different things where you are very, very important in this job. This is just a little overview at the beginning to show you what we're going to go through today. So first off, we're going to start off with the diagnostics. So this is a brief sort of overview what kind of diagnostics are out there. So this will also be the little bit more drier part of this presentation. But I think it is necessary for you to know what diagnostics are regularly done to work up cancer patients. And this, I think, will allow you to get a bit of background information about what the vet is doing in certain situations. And you then, on the other hand, will be prepared what to do in those situations. Then we're going to become a little bit more practical and go through five different case examples. So there are dogs and cats that may very well be cases that you are that you will be involved in. So that will then give you a bit more of a practical background to all the diagnostics we're discussing first. And then last but not least, which is not purely has not purely anything to do with the diagnostic approach, but very, very important is actually the involvement with the client and, of course, the patient as well. So we're starting off with some diagnostics here now. So those are just some random pictures of the few diagnostics that we will be discussing in the next few minutes. So we'll start off with something fairly simple. So bloods are probably something that we're very much know about what to do with that. So very often we'll use bloods to run a hematology and to run a serum biochemistry. FNA may be something that you guys have done yourself or the vet has done. So FNA standing for fine needle aspirate. And the picture here on the right essentially showing you the very limited equipment that you need for that to achieve something that can look like this picture here, which you can get from taking cells out of a mass. Next thing you might be doing in-house are tissue biopsies. So you might want to take it this extra step further than just an FNA. This may be because the vet is more comfortable with taking a biopsy, or he or she suspects that an FNA may not be enough for this patient. What you might also do, but could potentially be a bit trickier depending on what equipment you have, what experience your vet has, is a bone marrow biopsy. So this might also be something you may be asked to help with. Diagnostic imaging will very much depend on the equipment you have available in your practice or clinic. So this could, for some, be a CT scan, as shown here, and I think more and more practices actually do have access to that. And then a bit easier, what probably the majority will have access to is radiographs and ultrasound machines. So now we're just going to go through in a little bit more detail about these diagnostics and where they might be important for cancer patients. So we'll start off with bloods again. So very often our cancer patients are geriatric patients. Yes, there is a small percentage where they're younger, but nonetheless we use bloods routinely as a health check. Very often, however, in cancer patients, they don't actually say anything about the advanced stage of cancer or how these animals are feeling. So very often those bloods are actually normal. There are a few points, however, what we should look out for in those bloods. And I've just listed a few here that you might come across. Because sometimes in a day-to-day practice life, things can get hectic, appointment slots are short, and it is very important, especially for those cancer patients, that hopefully nothing gets overlooked. So if you've got a vet that is very busy, trying to juggle multiple patients at the same time, then you have a very important job to look out for those bloods, not just for the results to come in, but potentially have a little look at the results as well to see if you can spot something. And one of those certainly could be the lymphocyte count. So lymphocytes is a type of white blood cell, and you might find on your hematology that the lymphocyte count could be increased, which would be a lymphocytosis. Or it could be decreased, which is a lymphopenia. So lymphocytosis is actually something that you'll be much more interested in, because if you've got a raised lymphocyte count, that may immediately make you or the vet suspicious for something like lymphoma or leukemia, so a bone marrow involvement might be going in. So these are scenarios where the bloods may not come back as normal, and they might be quite important in making a diagnosis. The next one to look out for may be the hematocrit, which essentially gives you an idea about the amount of red blood cells. So again, this could be increased or decreased. Increased is probably something you'll see less commonly in cancer patients. Increased hematocrit is also referred to as polycythemia. And you may see this with bone marrow involvement, and you could see it with kidney involvement. More commonly, you will find a decreased count, so an anemia. Anemia is generally the case due to chronic disease, which is the case for a lot of cancer patients. Or you might see an anemia due to bone marrow involvement or due to bleeding that may be going on. Another important one to look out for is the platelet count. So again, as the same as for the other two cell lines, it could be increased or decreased. In case of increased, we're speaking about thrombocytosis, which sometimes occurs because of a paraneoplastic syndrome. So paraneoplastic essentially meaning it is concurrent or together with the cancer. More commonly, however, you might actually see a thrombocytopenia where the platelet count is decreased, purely because there might be bone marrow involvement, there could be a bleed and the platelets were lost, or there could be an immune-mediated component that sometimes occurs as well. So those were all hematological findings. And then the last 2 points, 4 and 5 here, are things that you're more likely to see, obviously, on the biochemistry. So one important one here is the calcium levels. So in the biochem, you will only get the total amount. But if the total calcium level is already increased, that should then prompt you to actually ask for an ionized value, because only the ionized value will actually be increased with certain cancers. And the main sort of cancers that increase calcium levels, the main one is probably lymphoma, which you're probably quite likely to encounter. Another one is anal sac adenocarcinoma. And other ones that are a lot rarer are things like thyroid carcinomas or mammary tumors. The next one to look out for is kidney and liver values. So actually, more importantly than the reason I've listed here on your slide is actually to check the animal for comorbidities. I've already said at the beginning we're dealing with geriatric patients, so the diagnosis of cancer might actually not be the only problem they're coming with, and sometimes their concurrent diseases could be more severe than the actual cancer diagnosis. But certainly kidney and liver values especially, they could also be increased if there is infiltrative disease. And that very commonly occurs with, again, lymphoma. but can also occur with mast cell disease, for example. So on this slide, I just want to talk briefly about FNA. So I already said it is a fairly quick and straightforward method to get an initial answer about what sort of mass or lump you're dealing with. And FNA is really possible with any sort of mass, especially if we're talking cutaneous or subcutaneous, that is easily accessible. And you don't really need a lot of equipment for that. So you need some slides. I generally perform the aspirate with a 23 gauge needle, and I express the material onto the slide with a 5 mL syringe. Now, I don't expect you as a nurse or any vet out there to actually use this as an in-house tool to make a diagnosis. But what I think should probably be done and should be possible is if you take multiple slides, if you stain just one of them to have a little look at cellularity, because obviously you're performing this test, the owner is going to pay money for it, and ideally you obviously want a diagnosis from it. So things that you can look out for in practice, and again you may be asked to do this for the vet, is to do the stain. And then what to look out for is essentially something that's called a monolayer. So you want to see, like in this slide, in this picture here, individual cells that can be very close to one another, but ideally you don't want them overlapping. So if you do see lots of cells, they are nicely spread out, then very confidently you can say that this should be diagnostic and you can send it off. Just on a note here, a lot of cutaneous and subcutaneous masses in dogs can be mast cell tumors. Now, obviously, you don't know that before taking the sample, but some practices are already considering to pre-medicate those dogs with an antihistamine. So, for example, with chlorpheniramine to prevent any degranulation from happening. And degranulation meaning the mass can increase in size. There may be a lot of oozing and bleeding from the lump, so that is something to potentially keep in mind if you aspirate any cutaneous or subcutaneous mass. So the next one, tissue biopsy, we've briefly spoken about that before, so that may be done instead of an FNA or even at the same time to increase your chances of making a diagnosis and not to have to sedate or anesthetize the animal again, so you get everything done in one go. The pictures on your right here, what they actually show is not a tissue biopsy, but a bone marrow biopsy. And they are taken with a Jamshidi needle. So now the needle on this picture here is a Jamshidi needle, but there are very different ones. And it may very much depend on what the vet feels comfortable with, what they have trained with. So there are different handles. So you may not have this exact one in your practice. You might have a different one there, but it does not really matter what type of Jamshidi needle. Why would you do that? Why would you take a bone marrow biopsy? So I've listed you two possible reasons here. One being cytopenias. So if you have an anemic patient and you can't find a reason why, there seems to be no disease on radiographs you can find, an abdominal ultrasound, the remaining bloods are fine, or you have just a thrombocytopenia. Or you have just a neutropenia. Sometimes, especially if you have bone marrow disease, you'll find that two or even three cell lines are affected and we'll speak of a pancytopenia. So that definitely warrants to take a bone marrow sample. Another reason may be hypercalcemia. So With hypercalcemia, you suspect lymphoma generally, anal sac adenocarcinoma. You might feel along the memory chain, the neck, to see if there's anything else that you can feel. And there's nothing really coming up on the physical exam. It may then be that you've got a leukemia or a lymphoma or a multiple myeloma sitting in the bone marrow only, and the only way to then detect this is by doing a bone marrow biopsy. So coming back to diagnostic imaging, we've already briefly discussed that you might have very different equipment in your practice. This is just here on a note for you to make you aware that some might do this under sedation, and some might do this under a general anesthetic, depending what is safe for the patient, what you feel comfortable with, and also your own safety. Some animals may be easier or more difficult to handle than others. So this is something you might want to consider, and we'll get back to these points of sedation and general anesthetic and monitoring that you may have to be comfortable with. So those are just some example pictures. This is a thoracic radiograph that in this case showed a miliary lung pattern. So this patient has metastasis throughout his lungs. This is the ultrasound picture from before. So this is an abdominal ultrasound, and these large sort of round dark areas, which they call hypoechoic, they represent lymph nodes. Right, so this is a little summary of the diagnostics we've spoken about now. So what means in-house diagnostics? So this is generally everything that you can do in-house, but you don't necessarily need to interpret all this in-house. So some of it you might actually send to an external lab to get an interpretation there. And this is essentially what your external diagnostics are. So a lot of practices nowadays have their own machines to run bloods. That might not be the practice you're working at. So you might have to send everything externally. I would certainly say if you do send bloods outside your own practice, always ask them to do a blood smear. A blood smear is very important, especially to verify the platelet count, is it true? The machine very often is wrong on this. The neutrophils, again, the machine may miscount this, especially if there are abnormal cells circulating in the bloodstream. I can guarantee you the machine will get it wrong. So the blood smear is a very good method to double check that. FNA, I said you might just look at that in-house to make sure it's actually diagnostic. Equally with some tumor types, the vet might be very happy to make a diagnosis, so you might actually do some of that in-house. Certainly histopathology is something that will be sent off. And for that, I'm sure every practice or clinic has the lab or a lab that they prefer to send their material to. That might be different depending on the sample you're sending. Especially if it's bone marrow, you might elect to send this to a different lab than the usual stuff. So that could be very different. One thing that's very important and that you might actually be involved with is the organization of formalin pots. And what is very frustrating for the pathologist and will be very frustrating for you and the vet, because you won't get the information you need, is if you've got a mass and you cut it through in order to put it in the formalin pot. So there's nothing more devastating. The pathologist can tell you what it is, but they won't be able to tell you if you removed it completely. So it's quite important to have the correct sized formalin pots. You might have very little ones for punch biopsies, but obviously if you're sending an entire spleen, for example, then you need a bigger pot. You need the correct lab forms that need to be filled out, and you need to be comfortable potentially filling those forms out and making sure that all samples go the correct way. And And the last note on this slide is a little vague, and I'll explain this on the next slide, is talking about additional tests that could be run on the material that's been sent off already. So what additional tests may there be? So let's say some tissue was sent in. So you've got your initial histopathology, and they are between two cancer types, but they can't determine it just based on what they're looking at through the microscope. So then your vet may ask for an immunohistochemistry, which may you might then actually be the person requesting it. So I felt that you may want a basic understanding on what these tests actually determine and do. Then we've got some other ones on here, which is a cytology, so you've sent off FNAs, which we can use for a very similar test in immunocytochemistry, and I'll explain that as well. Other things you can do with cytologies is a PAR. You might have heard that as well. And again, yet something else is a flow cytometry, which you can do, as you can see here, both on a cytology, but also on a hematology, so on bloods. So this is now speaking about those tests. So I've just summarized this with pictures because I thought that's going to hopefully make it clear. So I said to you, immunohistochemistry, cytochemistry, they work the same way, same mechanism. It's just one is with tissue, the other one is with just cells. So the green thing down here is essentially your tissue or your cell that you want to further characterize. And these tumor cells, they express certain proteins on their surfaces. And what you then do with the immuno is you throw antibodies onto your tissue, and this primary antibody essentially detects the proteins that may be expressed on the cell surface if it is the tumor cell you're looking for. So let's say now this antibody has docked onto this tumor cell. Then they're using a secondary antibody that then will dock onto this primary one. And this has the sole purpose of giving the whole thing a color. Because obviously this all happens on microscopic level. So how on earth are we going to see it if we don't involve something like color? So now this sounds very complicated. So on the next slide, it'll hopefully become a little bit more clear. So this is what this can look like. So you've now got your tumor cells. So this is all your little cells and tumor cells in here. And they have, obviously, comparing those two, reacted differently with their color. So the picture on the right here, where you can see all these little cells in their layers, they're stained blue. So this is a negative result. Comparing this with the one on the left, where you've got similar looking cells, but they all seem to be stained brown. And the reason for that is you've got all these little tumor cells, and they seem to express the protein where this antibody can go onto, and it's given it the color brown. And this is something that you can then see under the microscope. So I hope that wasn't too complicated, but that is just the basic theory, how those tests work and how the pathologist determines it's tumor A and not tumor B. So this is highly complicated, and I'm not going to explain this graph in any detail. So the thing you need to know about PAR is it stands for PCR antibody rearrangement. So it is a PCR reaction that we solely use to distinguish lymphoma from a reactive process. Reactive process meaning usually an inflammation. So to be more specific, very often it is used to distinguish lymphoma in the gut from inflammatory bowel disease. So that's one very classic example. And the theory behind it is that cancer Every little cancer cell is going back to one single clone. So we're talking about monoclonal. So that's one result you might get for, is it cancer? However, if it's inflammatory, then an inflammation we know has a variety of different cells. So we're expecting different peaks, meaning different origins of cells, so it will be polyclonal. And that's how differentiate, are we dealing with cancer slash lymphoma, or are we dealing with something reactive? Flow cytometry is a very fancy method. It's also used for lymphoma and leukemia mainly. So we can, for one, differentiate lymphoma from leukemia, but we can also give it a subtype. So we can, for lymphoma, say, is it B or T? Is it more likely an acute or chronic thing? And we can do the same for leukemia. So the brief theory behind flow cytometry is that the blood that you've taken, or the cytology out of a lymph node, let's say you've taken, it's all given into this tube here, where you see there is lots of little cells going through, and then they go through a second tube where they're kind of separated. So theoretically, all those little cells should come in front of this laser light source individually. And the information you then get from this is you get different cell sizes depending on what they are. They might have a different granularity depending on the cell type. And they might also express different cell surface proteins that are detected. And by doing that, you can tell, is it lymphoma? Is it leukemia? And what type is it? Right, so now everyone can take a little bit of a breather. So that was quite a long and potentially dry topic on diagnostics that we have to diagnose cancer, to diagnose certain comorbidities. So now in the next part with the cases, we're trying to make everything a little bit more practical. So you will see quite a few diagnostics being done on individual cases, and that might help you understand more why certain diagnostics are done and when. So case one here is a 13-year-old male neutered Russian blue. This cat has, as you can hopefully see on this picture, very large neck masses, which is what the owner essentially noticed. It's presenting for upper respiratory noises, which is not a huge surprise looking at this cat. The owner also reports some weight loss and inappetence, which again is not a huge surprise because the cat might actually struggle to swallow. So now you might be sitting at reception, seeing this owner in with his cat, and then you might then have to say to the vet that they have arrived. So now this cat may very well have an appointment because this has been going on maybe for a few weeks, but it could also come in as an emergency because maybe they have seen those neck masses, but they didn't do anything about it straight away, and only when the cat started breathing funny, that's when they realize something is actually very, very wrong. So this is certainly, especially being a cat, a very delicate patient and may require immediate attention. So you might be very comfortable in picking out those patients or triaging them and making the vet aware this has arrived. If you're not as comfortable with it, then certainly if you hear breathing noises, it may be a good idea to either ask the vet straight away to come out or ask a more experienced nurse to take a quick look, because those patients, they could easily die. This cat's stressed. It may have been transported and it is struggling to breathe already. So what can you do? So the first thing is obviously to engage with the patient and the owner. So you might want to take a quick look at this cat. Is it stable? Can it truly sit in the waiting room and wait for its appointment? Engage with the owner. The owner might be quite panicked. Their car ride may not have been straightforward and easy with that cat in the basket. This is certainly, especially if you feel the cat's not very stable, is maybe open mouth breathing, it might be a good idea to actually separate the cat from the owner and give it some oxygen somewhere to make it safe. Now, this cat has very obvious lesions, and it probably won't be the most stable patient to just go off and take some x-rays under sedation or do an abdominal ultrasound. So you probably want to focus on the obvious here, which are those neck masses. So you can probably do nothing wrong by organizing material stuff for FNA, potentially organizing things for a sedation, especially have an intubation set ready. This cat could collapse at any point, without any warning. Potentially get some blood tests ready. The vet might want to run some preliminary things before just sticking needles somewhere. So those are the things to keep in mind with a patient like that that could easily become unstable. So FNA was indeed something that was done in this case. And again, it doesn't really matter whether you're able to make a diagnosis in-house or if you just want to determine whether it will be diagnostic. And a sample like this is from this cat, shows multiple roundish-looking cells. But the important thing is they don't really overlap, so they're all lying in what we call a monolayer. The cellularity is very good, so this should be a diagnostic sample you can send off. And that was done, and it's come back as lymphoma. So that's an example for how easily FNA can be applied. You've got a patient here that's not very stable, so you can very likely get these FNAs consciously, and it should give you a relatively quick answer. So, now the diagnosis is made. The owner obviously knows there is something wrong. They've seen these large neck masses. The cat hasn't been breathing very well. So you may then want to take it, depending on your comfort level how the vet is engaging with the owner and yourself, take it one step further and actually also be present when the diagnosis is discussed or during treatment. The reason I'm saying that is very often in the practices out there, there are lots of locums, lots of locum vets, lots of vets go and travel in between branches, so their treatment and aftercare may not always be with the same vet. And I can promise you that especially for cancer patients, this continuity is actually very, very important for the owner. So you as a nurse might actually be the only continuity for them, whether you are the one meeting them at reception or you are the one helping a vet take bloods from their cat or administer chemotherapy later. So you are a very important factor in that relationship, and you'll probably give the owner this additional trust they need to feel comfortable with the treatment and everything. So case number two is now a 7-year-old male neutered beagle that presents for nothing other than this large right forelimb mass. They haven't noticed really anything else. They don't really know how long it's been there for, but they come in as sort of a routine appointment and they want this checked out. So similar as before, so they are probably, this kind of owner is probably either not hugely worried, they're coming as a routine appointment, they just want to know what's going on, or they're actually panicking, they've found a mass. They may have had a dog before with cancer, or the same dog here may have had cancer. So there might be different levels of intensity from the owner that you have to deal with. So now this is a subcutaneous mass. So a muscle tumor is a possibility. So again, as before, you in the practice may elect to give chlorpheniramine prior to taking any samples. So this is just again the list of equipment that you will need to take those FNIs. And I've just listed here clofenamin as antihistamine. That should, if you use it, give about 10, maybe 15 minutes IM or IV prior to FNA taking. If something happens despite the clofenamine injection, and if something happens meaning degranulation, which I briefly talked to you about before, so usually what happens is where you've poked it with the needle, that might be oozing profusely, there might be a lot of bleeding, the mass can double in size easily, that sometimes happens, and even the tissues around the mass might feel edematous and puffy and swollen. The dog itself might become very lethargic all of a sudden. And the skin in a beagle is obviously nice and white in places. So you might see that the pink skin goes very red, as if it was inflamed. So those are all signs of an anaphylactic reaction. And you may then have to be prepared to actually give this dog dexamethasone to counteract the degranulation. So again, a fairly simple way to make a diagnosis again is taking an FNA. This dog is stable. You're not going to lose any time by doing an FNA only. You don't need to go crazy. Some vets will certainly want to straight off go for a tissue biopsy, which is not a mistake, but FNA will be quicker. Quicker to give you an answer, well, or not give you an answer. And it's a fairly easy test and you don't need any sedation or anesthetic. So again, we're doing our little in-house thing. And what you look for, you're staining this one slide and you see, yes, some of those little cells seem to be clumping up together, but these are just red blood cells. So we're not really interested in what they're doing. What we are interested in are the cells that look differently. So these larger round cells here that are, some of them are quite close to one another, but they aren't really overlapping. And you can see quite nicely their cell borders. And you can also see that they've got little granules in them. So that is a very typical picture for a mast cell tumor. And it may even be that if you've seen it yourself or your vet's comfortable, that might even be a diagnosis you can make in-house. So again, similar to before, so I don't know now if this client was very intense in panicking about this mass or if they've truly seen it as a routine thing. Well, there's this mass, we need to do something about it. It's again important to engage with the owner following a diagnosis because this dog's likely looking at surgery. Depending on what the histopathology then says, they might also look at chemotherapy treatment. So this is also certainly a patient that you potentially going to see again. Right, case number three is now an 8-year-old female neutered Labrador. The history here for this dog is a bit more severe. So this dog comes in with weakness, it's lethargic. The owner reports there have been multiple collapsing episodes. And then you see on its belly after clipping, there are petechiae and ecchymoses. You may have also seen this on the dog's gingiva. That's often where you find them as well. So this is a patient that if it doesn't come in as an emergency, should be treated as such, because this is probably an unstable patient that can't just sit in the waiting room waiting for its appointment. So this is probably a case that should be triaged by yourself, a more experienced nurse or a vet, and probably be taken into a room somewhere and needs to be dealt with straight away. So what can you do? It may be the vet is still busy with another case, or there is just no one else at that time. They all seem to be busy. It's no mistake to start some form of supportive care. So that will start with likely triaging this case in the waiting room or taking them away because you just don't feel comfortable doing it in the waiting room. taking them in a consult room, if there is a free one, and TPRing this patient. So just do basic things like temperature, heart rate, respiratory rate, which might then already give yourself or the vet an idea on what's going on. But at least that's done. The next thing that will not be a mistake to do is to organize an IV access. We've already said this dog had collapsing episodes. It's very weak. It might even be tachycardic, so have a racing heart rate. So it will be a good idea to organize an IV catheter here, because if something happens, you at least have this IV access that you can use immediately. Another thing that you could do, but I should have swapped those two, take some bloods beforehand, but the dog is weak, so fluid therapy is likely a very good thing. So if you do take bloods, that is probably something you should then discuss with the vet, briefly run the case past them, or they might have had a few seconds or minutes to have a look at the patient themselves. So you might be asked to do a PCVTP, even a coagulation profile if you can do this in-house, or collect some for it to be sent off. At least it's done. And if you do a PCV, TP, or you might collect blood for an entire hematology, don't forget the blood smear, because if there is a problem here with the platelets, which could be decreased because of these petechiae, or you have atypical, so abnormal cells in the bloodstream, then the hematology, I almost want to guarantee it, will be wrong in at least one cell line. And you actually have to either, you're good at doing a blood smear and interpreting it yourself, or you need to be prepared to send it off for interpretation. This patient, you will likely want to do some more investigations with as well. So you may need to consider sedation and anesthesia for it, but I would probably only consider this after these initial things are done and maybe you already have some form of idea what might be going on based on those, or you've got no idea whatsoever, but then you may want to make the patient a little bit more stable before doing anything else. So in this case now, a blood smear was done, and what that showed was circulating large round cells. You also struggled to find many white blood cells, so you presume it is low as well. You can't find any platelets whatsoever. So we've talked about this before. So what is going on here? So we've got a neutropenia, a thrombocytopenia. Maybe there is a beginning anemia as well. So that's called a pancytopenia. So the first thing that should jump to mind is that there's probably some form of bone marrow disease going on. So you've got two choices. So you can either send your blood off for flow cytometry now, because there seem to be quite a few of those circulating large round cells, so that may be enough to get then a diagnosis via flow. Or you might want to wrap it all up and want to get an answer as quick as possible. You can still send off for flow to see if it's diagnostic or not, because that might come back within a day or two. But you can also, if the patient is stable, proceed with a bone marrow, because that's likely where the source of your disease is going to be. So the bone marrow, if you're happy, if your vet's happy doing it, it will be diagnostic, but you may not need it if the flow cytometry is already diagnostic. But you can still wrap it all up in one go. So this is just the little image of the blood smear. So as expected, you're actually seeing some little red blood cells in here, so that's quite normal. And then you've got a normal little lymphocyte in there, so that's what you would expect in the bloods. But then you see these really large cells that almost look like monocytes. I don't know if you are used to looking at blood smears, but that you could get the idea. They look a bit like monocytes. They're large cells. They're bigger than a lymphocyte and a red blood cell. So it could be a monocyte. So probably what your hematology machine is going to do is going to come back as a monocytosis to you. That's not true. That's why the blood smear is so important. So what this actually is lymphoma. So they're very large round cells in the bloods. You'll also find them in the bone marrow. So that'll give you the diagnosis of lymphoma here. Again, the owner here will very likely be devastated. They already brought this patient in being very, very unwell. So they do suspect that something really bad is going on with it. And then you tell them their dog's got lymphoma. It's got bone marrow involvement, which has not a very good prognosis. So it might be, when I say engage with owner here, it might be preparing them to try chemotherapy to see if it works and it can get them to maybe 6 months. But it might also be that the vet starts a discussion about euthanizing the patient. The dog's not very well. It's got a terminal disease. There might also be some personal history with the owner that they will likely tell you about at that point. So it is again very important for you as this constant figure that they're likely going to see to be involved and help them make a decision. Case four is less severe. So this is a 6-year-old male with a domestic short hair, a very obvious nasal lesion, looks like it's already sort of eaten its way through the nasal planum, which is essentially gone, and it looks like you've got a bit of lip involvement here as well. The cat also presents for upper respiratory noises. So again, as before, you take a look at this cat when it comes in. Certainly when I saw it, it was, yes, it made upper respiratory noises, but it didn't appear awfully stressed. It wasn't open mouth breathing. So that's probably a case that can probably wait for its appointment. Nonetheless, if you're worried again, and you may be worried because you're inexperienced or you just want to be overly cautious, which is absolutely fine, you might want to again move them into a room where you can provide oxygen if necessary. So for this one, what is probably fairly obvious to do, you've got a fairly obvious lesion here, so you could do some impression smears, you could elect to take a biopsy, for which you'll have to anaesthetize, or you could try some FNAs depending on how cooperative this cat is. Same as before, well, you very well know now what to organize for FNAs and what you need. Formalin pot, you probably don't need a very big one because it is just likely a little punch biopsy or a wedge biopsy. You might also want to organize a minor procedure kit. So obviously your biopsy equipment, but there might also need to be some suture material or surgical glue if it's only a small little lesion, or some swabs if the vet suspects maybe this isn't cancer, maybe this is something more bacterial or fungal, let's say. So in this case, we decided to go for a biopsy. So hence, this was sent for a histopathology. It was a punch biopsy. And this now looks a little different. So obviously, we've talked lots about monolayer before. And this doesn't really look like a monolayer. This looks pretty horrible. So you won't be able to detect any individual cells here. But thankfully, the pathologist does obviously not only get this one picture. They're going to be scrolling through. So you see that this material is kind of sitting in this pinkish background, and you can make not really the cell borders you can't see, but you can see these weird little segmented, almost broken looking like cells in here. So those are neutrophils. Not a huge surprise. Now, if I remember what this lesion looked like, looked pretty nasty. So to have neutrophils there is not surprising. But the ones we're interested in are these big round guys here that almost look like fried eggs. So they are very large, and you can spot them in here, and you can spot them here. And this is essentially a squamous cell, so like a skin cell. And this picture, together with the neutrophils, is diagnostic for a squamous cell carcinoma. So that's not going to be a huge surprise. The nasal lesion is a very typical location, and it is, yeah, a red white sort of cat. So again, engage with the owner following a diagnosis, because they might have a very big surgery ahead of them with this cat, that they will likely need some guiding. Right, that's our last case. So this is an 8-year-old male-neutered Labrador retriever. It comes in the door with a distended abdomen. The owner says the dog's been weak and had also some collapsing episodes. So again, similar to the patient before, that's probably also not a case you want to just leave sitting in the waiting room. So what was done in this case, they've seen the distended abdomen. So they, first of all, they probably thought it was a GDV. So they thought, let's just pop it on the table, have a little look what's going on. It's no GDV here. But what is here is that there is a bit of loss. If you compare this area with this, then you feel like this one has loss of detail, and that's the area of the spleen and liver. So you do suspect there might be some free fluid in there. So same thing as before. You can't be wrong TPRing this patient. You can't be wrong organizing an IV access, putting it on fluids. Likely with that degree of fluid in there, the femoral pulses are likely weak. So you'll help this patient with fluids. You can also organize some bloods here already, to see what's going on. And you may need to be prepared to set up for a sedation anesthetic as well, because there's likely more that needs to be done. What was done here is the X-ray was suspicious for free fluid, so it is not a surprise that we went for abdominal ultrasound to have a little look. And what we found here is this is the spleen, and this looks all relatively homogeneous, but then you've got this big sort of lump sitting here which is cavitated. So that's obviously not normal. The next very obvious thing to do is you've got fluid in there, tap it. Tap it, not meaning take all the fluid out, just take a little bit to see, is this, could this be a transudate? Is it looking clear? Is it yellowish? Is it serosanguinous, where it is like reddish? Or does it look like blood? Which in this case it did. Together with the splenic mass, they opted for surgery, which was done to remove the spleen. The spleen in its entirety was sent off for histopathology, and that's the picture. So the histopath shows these large sort of spindloid looking cells together with red blood cells in between. And that's a fairly typical picture for an hemangiosarcoma. So the history is very typical for it, the histopath is typical, and also the fact that it is the spleen. Right, so last but not least, so this is the last bit, just sort of summarizing your involvement with the patient and with the owner. So on the top right, I've put comforting and restraining. So obviously you do play an important role in restraining an animal so that a vet can take a blood sample, take FNAs, or do whatever. But you're not only just restraining, you're actually comforting the animal. You'll be the one that detects whether this animal gets nervous under your hands. If it is maybe an unstable patient where you might want to say, I'd like to have some oxygen mask here, because I feel this patient is becoming quite agitated and has respiratory noise. So you'll be the one so literally feeling this under your fingers. Then you will be involved with the anesthesia, sedation, and more importantly, the monitoring. So I know there are other CPD things out there, or seminars you can take to increase your comfort levels with this. So I'm personally always a bit worried about anesthetics and sedations, probably a lot of it because it's out of my comfort zone. That's not what I do very frequently. But you have got a very, very important job because the vet is probably focusing on taking a tissue biopsy, doing a bone marrow, doing a surgery. So the whole monitoring, is the patient alive? Is it doing well? That responsibility lies with you. And there is no shame if you feel still too inexperienced to deal with this situation and get someone in with you to help, or make the vet aware of the fact that you haven't done that many, but you will obviously learn by doing so. Depending on where you work, you might, and that takes it a little bit further now than just diagnosing cancer, is the treatment that you might also be involved with administering chemotherapy. And then back to comforting and engaging, it is not just the patient itself that is important, especially with cancer patients. The onus will be very, very emotional. They will likely tell you their background stories, and there will likely be cancer in their family somewhere, which they will discuss with you, and they will put all that emotional on you that you have to deal with. So it is a lot about comforting the owner as well and guiding them and helping them through this journey of diagnosing and treating cancer in their animal. So with that, I'd like to conclude this. This is little Benjamin. He was one of my patients. So on that note, he was very, very happy. I'd like to say thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned a lot. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Irina for a great presentation today. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.